Matthias Overstolz knew it was over. He would soon die on this night of 15th October 1268. In the nocturnal shadows of the Ulpforte Tower, he lay mortally wounded, dimly lit by the moonlight. It would be the last thing he would see of Cologne in 1268, but Matthias, or in English Matthew, smiled. Two of his followers saw him lying there on the ground, came over to him and lifted him up, but he immediately waved them away. "You fools, we are winning, don't worry about me, I'm dead anyway, keep fighting, God is honoring Cologne today, that is why I want to die happily." And no sooner had he uttered these words than Matthias Overstolzen breathed his last breath, knowing full well that his family had changed the history of Cologne forever that night. And with that, welcome back to the History of Cologne, a podcast about the history of the city of Cologne that is over 2,000 years old. But until it became what it is today, this old city on the Rhine has endured a colorful and rich past, hence it can therefore be seen as a microcosm of European history. In this podcast, you can listen as the city grows, from the Romans up until our present time. Cologne was not conquered by hostile foreign forces for 1,000 years. Since being pillaged by the Vikings at the end of the 9th century, the city had managed to protect itself with its city walls. But here in 1268, things are about to get very, very close, because the enemy is not only camped outside the city, it is also in the midst of the people in the city. The Battle of Vorringen is well known among history enthusiasts in the Rhine, and not to you English native-speaking guys, I know, but to many people in the Rhine. After all, it had European dimensions. However, the battle that took place 20 years earlier and paved the way for it is less well known, the Battle of Ulpforte, located right in today's Südstadt South Town district, only 50 meters away from where I lived as a student at the time. Disclaimer, I am not a fan of violence, including battles. I find it very terrible when people inflict violence on each other, whether in the past or nowadays. As a historian, I must of course examine such events because they can be used to explain many other political, social, and economic issues in addition to the outbreaks of violence. I must warn you about the Battle of Ulpforte, though. It has been handed down mainly by the city's chronicler Gottfried Hagen. Here, historically documented facts merge with legend. Even Cologne's nowadays historians are not always able to separate the two. However, there is no doubt that the battle took place. This is mainly because several prominent figures from Cologne and the surrounding area at that time were found dead on the ground here at the end of the events. So, how did this battle within the city come about in October 1268? Let's find out. The political situation at the beginning of 1268 had actually been relatively calm. The current ruler of the city, Archbishop Engelbert von Falkenburg, was a prisoner of the Count of Jülich at Nideggen Castle in what is now the district of Düren. This meant that the long years of violence against Cologne were over for the time being, as the Archbishop had constantly tried to regain power in the city. In doing so, he had completely lost his way and alienated himself from the regional rulers. The consequence, in a battle near Zülpich in October 1267, right outside of Cologne, he was taken prisoner by the Count of Jülich. He would remain there as a prisoner until April 1271, but anyone who thought that the Lord of Cologne was out of the game was mistaken. Even in captivity, Engelbert von Falkenburg knew how to be a dangerous opponent. The city would soon feel the effects of this. So let's review the chronology. In October 1267, the city lord was taken prisoner in the Battle of Zülpich. And now in January 1268, the intrigue began to unfold, culminating in October of the same year in the Battle of Ulpforte that we heard of in the intro. At that time, there was unrest among the wealthiest class of Cologne citizens, the patricians. As you know, the political system of The city of Cologne was complicated and, from our present-day perspective, not always entirely logical in terms of the distribution of power. The Collegiate of Magistrates, that institution had existed for centuries. This was a body of around 24 men who had officially sworn an oath to the archbishop as lord of the city, but who had since become largely emancipated and independent of him. In fact, the Collegiate of Magistrates could be regarded as the city's highest civic body at that time. Actually, because in the 13th century, the Cologne City Council had also been formed. It was completely independent of the archbishop, but for much of the 13th century, it still had modest powers. The Collegiate of Magistrates was mainly made up of the city's old, powerful patrician families, above all the wise men of Mühlengasse, with their supporters, who had particularly large numbers of members there as a family, as a clan, so to speak. The young city council was mainly made up of the rising patrician families, like the Oberstolzen. And now, with their participation, the young Cologne city council had grown enormously in terms of power and prestige in earlier years, in recent years. This was because the members of the city council in particular had distinguished themselves in the fight against the archbishop recently. So things started moving power-like. The previous supremacy of the Collegiate of Magistrates slowly shifted in favor of the city council, and thus also in favor of the family of the Oberstolzen and their allies. This development did not go unnoticed by the imprisoned Archbishop of Cologne. He was only too happy to intervene in this emerging conflict and even stirring it up for his own advantage. Both sides of the dispute, the wise men of the Mühlengasse and the Oberstolzen, had in common that they were both rich and powerful, but in their composition they were extremely different. If the chronicler of that time, Gottfried Hagen, is to be believed, the party of the wise men of the Mühlengasse did not only include direct family members. The wise men were therefore not just a single family. They were organized like a joint party or faction in which the wise men set the tone together with all their supporters. In addition to the wise men themselves, this included families such as the Van der Alderir-Berin, I know, funny name, the Marsilis, and the Polheims family. However, Gottfried Hagen does not really tell us exactly who was a member of the wise man's faction. This is, for many historians, further evidence that the wise man's faction was seen more as a homogeneous front. While Gottfried Hagen always refers to the wise man party as a group with only one voice, this does not apply to the opponent side, the Oberstolzen side. This group is portrayed as more heterogeneous, if that's the right pronunciation in English. It is always emphasized that they, the Oberstolzens, joined forces with other families in the cities that were keen on keeping their independence. These are the dozen or so families who would later dominate the Cologne City Council in the 14th century. Who belonged to it? The Oberstolzen family had already split into several factions at that time. Among them, the most influential figures at that time were Matthias, whom we know, but also Gerhard, Matthias' son. Then there are other Oberstolzen family members as Rutger, Gottschalk and Konstantin. And now follows a simple list. Often one only knows the name, but not always the biographies behind the party members of the coalition against the wise men from the Mühlengasse. The Adochts were there, as was the Gier family. The Hardefusts, or the Hard Fists, that's what they called themselves, hesitated because they had good relations with both sides first. They did not want to choose between old friends and new allies, however they ultimately decided to side with the Oberstolzen. The Jude family was much more decisive, clearly positioning themselves as opponents of the wise men and neighbors of the Oberstolzens, being neighbors of the Oberstolzens in the Rheingasse alley, the street where the Oberstolzen lived in. The Kleingedank family were also hesitant at first, but then swung over to the Oberstolzens' side. I could go on listing names, But what is striking is that almost none of those listed by Gottfried Hagen as opponents of the Weismann von der Mühlengasse are represented in the old institution, the Collegiate of Magistrates, that for a long time ruled the city together with the Archbishop. Only Matthias Overstolz himself, Heinrich Kleingedank, and two others from other families from that Overstolzen faction were actually members of the College of Magistrates. So there's a clear dividing line here. On the other hand, we have the Weismann from the Mühlengasse that are particularly strongly represented there in the College of Magistrates and have their power base there, extending it to the Riecherzeche, the Brotherhood of the Rich, to which every magistrate automatically belongs. On the other side, we have the Overstolzen faction, where hardly anyone is a member of this old institution. They are rather members of the new, young city council. So, how did it come to this, with Cologne's patricians waging war against each other and thinking about that the Archbishop is always as a Damocles sword above their heads, threatening their position in the city at all? Well, after a short break, let's take a look why the patricians started fighting each other now. The Overstolzen and their allies were on the rise in the late 1260s. As members of the city council, they had ensured that the archbishop's attempts to take power in the city were repelled, something that could not be said about the Collegiate of Magistrates. Anyone who has power fears losing it again, said a chancellor of a galactic republic in a galaxy far, far away from us. And that also applies here to the family of the Weismann von der Mühlengasse. For much of the 13th century, they, the Weismann, had dominated the city as the leading civilian family, the patrician family. And now they saw themselves threatened with losing this status to the Overstolzens and their allies. And someone who is afraid does foolish things. As early as 1267, the Weismann of the Mühlengasse and the Archbishop explored the possibility of an alliance, because they were both losing power in Cologne. This remained active even after Engelbert von Falkenburg was taken prisoner the same year. Through intermediaries, the Archbishop had 100 marks, it's a big amount of money, delivered to the Weismann of the Mühlengasse, which they were to use to buy weapons. The Archbishop also supplied them with matching clothes, which could really be described as uniforms. This was something that had previously been completely unheard of among the citizens of Cologne. It was something that had only been seen in the large cities of northern Italy, that families, clans dressed up in the same colors, like a carnival or a club nowadays does. Armed and dressed people in uniform clothing, the Weismann of the Mühlengasse appeared now increasingly martial and self-confident in the city, being clearly recognizable as a common group that belonged together with might and power. Above all, Engelbert stirred up the Weismann's hatred of the Overstolzens as well. Now, all they needed, the Archbishop and the Weismann of the Mühlengasse, who now formed an alliance, was a pretext to take action against the Overstolzen and their allies. And what did the Weismann do? What was the trigger? They really rehashed an old story, which in my personal opinion was really old news. In German would say cold coffee, that is. Do you remember episode 74 in this podcast, when the Weismann of the Mühlengasse were expelled from the city for a very short time? It didn't matter that the Archbishop at the time was behind it as well, funnily enough. No, the Weismann of the Mühlengasse claimed that the arrogant Overstolzen family was behind it back then, and their allies, especially Hermann von der Kornforte, who was also on the side of the Weismann's opponents. And now, finally, 30 years later, the time had come to settle the score for honor, and you know, honor is everything in those days. All right, thought the people in the city, People in Cologne were well practiced by this. Now, when two sides are in dispute, you simply initiate arbitration proceedings, just like with the little and the big arbitration. Albertus Magnus, now proudly approaching his 70th birthday, did not act as arbitrator this time. However, he was away at the time and would not return to Cologne until 1269, where he would remain until his death in 1280. Therefore, the Count of Jülich was appointed, who in my opinion was admittedly not entirely neutral. After all, he was the current prison director of the Archbishop of Cologne. It was he who held Engelbert von Falkenburg captive in his castle in Nideggen, the man that was the ally of the wise men of the Mühlengasse. But anyway, listen and be amazed. The arbitrator from Jülich awarded the wise men of the Mühlengasse a large sum in compensation for what they had to endure 30 years earlier. The wise men received 600 marks on the city's coffers as reparation for something that had happened, as I said, 30 years ago, and had already been compensated for at the time. Perhaps this was intended to take the wind out of the sails of the wise man's agitation, the Count of Jülich and the Overstolzen thought. If this was the plan of the Count of Jülich and above all the Overstolzen, then the plan did not quite work out. The wise men of the Mühlengasse wanted to defend their existing power by any means necessary and to depower the up-and-coming families around the Overstolz. One thing to achieve that, as so often in the past, was to win other factions in the city, like the craftsmen's guilds, to your cause. Although militarily weakened in 1235 by the events of the last episode, they were still not to be underestimated in terms of the number of their members. The wise man promised them everything, so to speak, the abolition and exemption from all taxes and duties in return for helping destroy the Overstolzen. Was this offer really serious, or was it the increasing desperation of the wise men that led them to make such proposals? After all, the wise men had also done everything in their power to keep the crafts guild small in recent years, but now they wanted them on their side at all costs. His behavior did not escape the notice of the Overstolzens, of course, nor did it escape the notice of the arbitrator, the Count of Jülich. He accused the wise men of breaking the arbitration ruling and imposed penalties. Ludwig von der Mühlengasse was to hand over the Cologne's city seal in November 1267. The wise man possessed it as a member of the Collegiate of Magistrates and Mayor of the Richerzeche and kept it in the assembly house of it, the House of the Rich, near Altermarkt, the Old Market. Whoever possessed the seal of the city, to remind all of us, had power over the city's civic institution. This was because the seal, which depicted St. Peter, the city patron saint, surrounded by the Cologne city wall, could be used to issue and authenticate documents, and thus to engage in tangible politics. The surrender of the city seal must have seemed to the wise men of the Mühlengasse, first of all Ludwig of course, like a task to surrender the family politically, which he could not do at all. And we have to remember, arbitrator or not, the Count of Jülich did not have the authority to demand the surrender of the city seal. Ludwig therefore refused to hand over the city seal, which was also legally acceptable as he was acting mayor and magistrate. But Ludwig von der Mühlengasse was a little too eager. It was customary for the city seal to be kept in a clearly visible place in the House of the Rich, the predecessor building to Cologne City Hall on Altermarkt. This seal was to be shown there publicly and visible to everyone. The Overstolzens were astonished, as were many of the wise men's party members, I believe, when this seal was no longer there. It was gone, disappeared. Ludwig had taken it aside and hidden it, and he refused to hand it over, let alone reveal where he had hidden it. This was, of course, a clear breach of law. And at that moment, everything happened very quickly. The thieving Ludwig von der Mühlengasse was arrested. Denounced as thieves, the powerful wise man became extremely nervous about public opinion in the city. In November and December of 1267, the situation escalated to such an extent that the wise men, I mean all of them, hid in their well-fortified houses in the city and above all in monasteries and abbeys that were well-disposed towards them through personal relationships and donations. For secular power ended as soon as one entered a monastery. Here, secular power was not allowed to intervene. Thus, cornered, literally, November and December of 1267 passed. And when January came, the Overstolzen and their supporters perhaps felt too secure in their position. As mentioned, the wise men were still in the city, but they were hiding behind stone walls. January came and the Overstolzen and their allies suspected nothing, which was foolish because in the meantime Ludwig von der Mühlengasse had even managed to escape from prison and was secretly organizing his followers. On 10th January 1268, the Count of Jülich had a celebration at the Parfusenhof in Cologne. Naturally, I looked up where that is today. Of course, the courtyard no longer exists. It was probably located roughly where Breite Straße and Richmodestraße near Neumarkt Square meet today, northwest of the intersection, directly opposite of the West German television broadcasting station building. No longer so neutral, the former arbitrator, the Count of Jülich, celebrated a lively and cheerful feast with food and drink. Who was invited? All opponents of the wise men from the Mühlengasse, of course, including the Overstolzen family. The cheerful party was quickly over when the wise men from the Mühlengasse suddenly showed up as uninvited guests. They had waited for precisely this moment. All their enemies were in one place, unprepared and taken by surprise. Ludwig von der Mühlengasse was one of the leaders of the attack. There's no detailed account of the battle, but somehow most of the guests managed to flee and escape the fighting. The Overstolzen and the Count of Jülich in particular fled the city and sought refuge in the Mechtern Monastery, which corresponds roughly to today's Ehrenfeld district right outside of Cologne. The Parfusenhof, however, the courtyard, was completely looted by the wise men and then set on fire and destroyed. Afterwards, the wise men occupied the city gates. They left only 3 unguarded of the city gates. Why? I have no idea really, and I couldn't find out which 3 gates they left unguarded. On the same day, 10th January 1268, the wise men and their followers moved towards the Rheingasse and Filzengraben streets, which are located south of Heumarkt Square and directly on the Rhine. As inconspicuous as these streets may seem today, Filzengraben in particular is a mini motorway for cars to the Severance Bridge and the North-South Drive. It was a completely other street back then. In the 13th century, this was a prime residential area. The Overstolzen, the Jude family, and many other distinguished families of the city lived here. And now the wise men wanted to get down to business and tear down the houses of their enemies. So, people, don't ask me how. The Overstolzen family managed to return to Cologne in the meantime. Really, I've looked at literature and even the original text by Gottfried Hagen. The Overstolzen make it back to Cologne in time before the wise man can set fire to their homes. A bloody battle ensues, and Matthias Overstolz, mentioned in the introduction of this episode, encounters Ludwig von der Mühlengasse. This is far from a street brawl. This was murder going on. Ludwig manages to seriously wound Matthias Overstolz, but the tide of the battle turns. The Overstolzen, who had been taken by surprise, managed to gain the upper hand and put the wise men of the Mühlengasse and their followers to flight. A relative of Matthias, Rutger Overstolz, takes up the pursuit of Ludwig von der Mühlengasse. Together with his ally Heinrich von Krane, they pursue him to the nearby monastery St. Georg. There, the wise man Ludwig would be safe and under the protection of the church again, for, as I said, no one was allowed to be killed in the consecrated district of a monastery, At least, not if they didn't want to burn in hell for eternity. But before Ludwig von der Mühlengasse, the mayor and one of the leaders of the wise men of the Mühlengasse, one of the most powerful citizens of Cologne, reaches the protective monastery, his enemies catch up with him. While Matthias Overstolz survives the attack, seriously wounded this time, Ludwig von der Mühlengasse falls victim to his opponent's swords on this 10th of January 1268, as do many other members of his family. Those who manage to flee find themselves trapped in the same place once again, in monasteries. They are safe for the time being in the surrounding monasteries and convents, but they are prisoners again. The Overstolzen would not allow themselves to be taken by surprise with the same trick again inside their city. The Overstolzen immediately made it clear that the wise men of the Mühlengasse could not stay in the city. They had to leave. Exile was the punishment for this cowardly act they had just done. The next day, 11th January 1268, the wise men of the Mühlengasse were accompanied to the Rhine by the Count of Jülich, who vouched for their safe passage. There, the wise men boarded ships that took them to neighboring Bonn in the south of Cologne, a city that was owned by the Archbishop. Of course, they did not meet the Archbishop himself there. Engelbert von Falkenburg would remain a prisoner at Nideggen Castle for another 3 years. The Overstolzen and their supporters had succeeded for the moment. The Archbishop remained in captivity outside of Cologne, and they had also prevailed among the city's elite. Everything could have been fine, couldn't it? However, the Archbishop, Engelbert von Falkenburg, continued to assert his old recognized right to be the Lord of Cologne, and the wise men had no intention of giving up either. Through constant exchanges of messengers, the wise men planned their return to Cologne, together with the Archbishop of Cologne, while being in exile. And this was to eclipse the carnage they had instigated on 10th January. And this brings us to the events of October of the same year, 1268, with which we began this episode. Until autumn, the year 1268 remained peaceful for the time being. And you know how it often is with historical sources. Poverty is not sustainable in historical sources. Historical written sources usually only tell us about kings, emperors, bishops, and wealthy citizens, even up until now. We often do not know what servants, maids, craftsmen, women in general, children or servants thought. Even if only briefly, we now get such an insight in the autumn of 1268. A little bit, just a blink of an eye, so to speak, but better than nothing. You know how it is. Since 1180, Cologne, with its expanded medieval area and city wall, has been like a large semicircle enclosing the Rhine to the east. Far away from the large squares, an impoverished cobbler and candlemaker lived on the city. Close to the city wall, next to the city wall, in an arch of it near the Ulrupforte gate, one of the city gates on the land side. This was where most of those who built themselves simple dwellings lived. Some of them were semi-legal. The fact that his hut was built directly onto the city wall had the advantage of saving on building materials and meaning he had one less wall to build. Fate had not been kind to this man. As is so often the case in history, he remains nameless. Only his nickname has been passed down by the town chronicler Gottfried Hagen. He calls him Havenit, meaning have not. So, because he's poor, he's nicknamed have not. So, we must make do with this name, Havenit. Havenit's plight was shamelessly exploited by Archbishop Engelbert von Falkenburg. Through messengers, for the Archbishop was still in prison, he contacted Havenit and made him an offer that he could hardly refuse in his predicament. He was to dig a hole under the city wall from inside his hut. In return, he would receive money that would relieve him of all material worries for the rest of his life. 25 marks. A lot of money for a poor resident of Cologne. Remember, the archbishop had given 200 marks for the wise men to buy themselves weapons and uniforms. That's a lot of money back then. So Havenit has to do something like a medieval prison break, even though he's not really in a prison, but he has to dig a tunnel. The Overstolzen family had no idea that a man like Havenit, whom a patrician would not even deign to look at, was now working away in his house for weeks on end, digging for all he was worth and secretly disposing of the excavated earth. For the deal stipulated that the hole had to be large enough for two horses to pass through the tunnel side by side, and dear friends, I tell you, truth and legend are certainly intertwined here. The conspiracy spreads even wider. The wise men of the Mühlengasse were naturally involved in this conspiracy. They wanted to return to Cologne and regain their lost status as the most powerful patrician family in the city. But as I said, the mastermind behind it was still the Archbishop Engelbert von Falkenburg, who was in captivity, for he pulled all the strings. Old allies of him were also on board, hoping to be able to put the powerful Count of Jülich in his place, who was currently allied with the city of Cologne and above all the Overstolzen. Among the Archbishop's allies were the Duke of Limburg, named Walram, and the Count of Kleve Dietrich, who is also well known to us from earlier episodes. As Engelbert von Falkenburg was unable to lead the group of fighters himself due to his imprisonment, he sent his brother Dietrich von Falkenburg as their leader. This last piece of information is a tragic irony. Around 10 years earlier, this Dietrich von Falkenburg had fought on the side of the city of Cologne. At the time, he was fighting against the then Archbishop of Cologne, Konrad von Hochstaden. Now that his brother was Archbishop, he had naturally changed sides. But now there was a long-standing problem. They, the Archbishop, the wise men from the Mühlengasse, and all their allies, they had an army that could march on Cologne, yes, but the city walls were still in the way. Sure, they had a tunnel, but it would take time for everyone to slip through, all those 300 to 500 men, and above all, it would attract attention. Enough time to organize an effective defense in the city. So the Archbishop tried once again to win over the craft guilds. Since their decisive defeat against the patricians a few years earlier, they had naturally been waiting for their chance to regain political significance. They agreed to start a riot in the city if the wise men could provide at least 500 fighters for the attack. This would serve as a distraction, giving the wise men and their Archbishop's allies enough time to enter the city through the hole in the wall near the Ulrichpforte Gate. Once the power of the Overstolzen had been broken after the battle, they would march together to Nideggen Castle and free the imprisoned Engelbert von Falkenburg, their Archbishop. And then their goal would be achieved. The wise man would be back in power, and the Archbishop of Cologne would once again be the city's supreme ruler. Well, let's see how that will go. On the night of 14th October 1268, the wise men and the Archbishop's allies dare to attack. But we also know that war requires more than just materials and enough people. The attackers had that, sure, but something went wrong with their communication. An undertaking with so many participants could simply not remain a secret. To cut a long story short, the Overstolzens simply got wind of it, and the guilds did not really start their riots at first. The other thing was, and we already talked about it, when people slip through that gate, they must gather on site first. You must understand that the area around the Ulrichpforte Gate, it was within the city walls, of course, it was still very rural. There, it was not in the middle of downtown. The area was characterized by agricultural land. It is quite noticeable when at night, suddenly, There are not crops, but around 500 fighters standing in the field. They were certainly not the quietest of people as well. And to show you that how rural this area is around that city gate, I will put a map on my homepage, thehistoryofcologne.com. A resident named Winkelbart saw his front garden filling up with more and more fighters. Under cover of darkness, he ran to the Rheingasse, which was about a mile away, and alerted the Overstolzen family and all the other patricians who lived there. Cologne was under attack, and they had to get ready now if they didn't want to be murdered in their beds in their sleep. The hole under the city wall, let's be honest, was probably not as wide as had been reported. No horse could ride through the tunnel. The fighters of the wise men and the archbishop's men probably squeezed through a narrow hole one by one. And they, now, were immediately trapped when the Overstolzen, as well as other patrician families, heavily armed in knight's armor, began to slaughter them one by one. Don't forget that almost all patricians in Cologne loved to imitate the knightly lifestyle. As wealthy citizens, they had the money and the time to train in combat and equip themselves like knights. The leader of the attackers, Dietrich von Falkenburg, the archbishop's brother, dies in the battle. And Matthias Overstolz, as I said, is seriously wounded again, as he was in January, but so seriously this time that he will die from his injuries. For a moment, it seemed as if the tide might turn in favor of the wise men still, because the guilds show up that had conspired with the wise men and the archbishop. They arrive at the Ulrupforte far too late and still could now decide the outcome of the battle if they chose the side of the wise men. But when they saw that, what was happening right now, in addition to the Overstolzen and their families, people from all of parts of Cologne were fighting alongside them, they saw who the city seems to be on the side of the Overstolzens, and they decided not to intervene on the side of the wise men and the archbishop and stayed or remained neutral. The battle ends with many dead on both sides, but with a clear victory for the Overstolzen. Duke Walram of Limburg is captured. Dietrich von Falkenburg is dead, but even on the side of the Overstolzen, Gerhard mourns the death of his father Matthias. Peter Jude is also a prominent casualty on the side of the defenders. Unfortunately, and that was really a question that bothered me, I cannot answer you. What happened to that poor cobbler named Havenit? What happened to him? I have no idea. The sources don't say anything about that. The Battle of Worringen, which would take place 20 years later after this battle at the Ulrupforte Gate, is much better known in Cologne than the Battle of Ulrupforte. But without the Ulrupforte, there would have been no battle in Worringen. What were the consequences of the Battle of the Ulrupforte? The internal patrician struggle in the city came to an end. The wise men of the Mühlengasse were driven out of Cologne. I mean, many of them were killed anyway. Over time, some were allowed to settle in Cologne again, but their power was broken forever. Most of the wise men settled in other cities and scattered all across the empire. The families, mainly from Rheingasse and Filzengrabe, like the Overstolzens, now formed a united front. There was now only one person left in the city who would challenge the patrician rule over the city, the archbishop. I would like to talk about further implications in the next episode. Because this episode is already much too long, we have to do that next time. And we also need to discuss the implications, because the wise men from the Mühlengasse leave a big gap in the city, power-wise, for example, in the Collegiate of Magistrates. Many thanks this time to Antje, Andreas, Heinrich, Stefan, Karin, Sven, Silvia, Stephanie, and Friedel for your tips via PayPal. My sources were Hugo Stehkämper in Karditma, Cologne in the High Middle Ages, then Manfred Groden's Cologne in the 13th century, and Cologne Legends by Goslin Peter Gart. I also took a peek at the original text by Gottfried Hagen, a book I once bought in an antique bookshop for a few euros. It was published in 1847. Thank you very much for listening. Please recommend me to others and auf Wiedersehen.